integrating non-pharmaceutical and multimodal treatments into treatment models is the key to really transformative healthcare.
Our health system is more than clinicians and insurance agencies. It's more than national or state policy and economics. It's even more than personal relationships and environment. It's also business and innovation. Many of the established structures are money-making machines, but the debt our system has generated makes it clear that something is off. Something's inefficient, ineffective, misdirected. Good policy can help solve many of our problems, and so can good business. This is Contributing Factors, Season 1, Episode 5. This series is produced by Health Further, and I'm Caroline Leland, your host. This episode is fifth in a series designed to explore every side of depression. So far, we've covered clinical, social, political, and economic. In this episode, we're talking about businesses working on mental health. Don't forget that you can hear the full conversations with everyone we interviewed for this episode by going to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors and clicking on the page for episode 5. And as always, we need to remind you that nothing in this episode or any of the others can or should be taken as medical advice. If you need help, please seek a medical professional. Now, business and innovation in mental health. We're going to highlight several examples of companies that are using technology to make health more accessible and improve people's lives while fulfilling their other mandate, which is to be viable as a business. In other words, making money. We like this because it aligns with our core value that health should be affordable and sustainable. This means that we believe there are ways to align the needs of patients with economic realities and a chance for innovators and entrepreneurs to be rewarded for their work. In particular, we're drawing heavily from our conversation with the CEO of a mobile app company called BreatheAware. Quick disclaimer that BreatheAware is in the portfolio of our sister company, Jumpstart Foundry. We chose to spend a lot of time with them here because of the work they're doing and not that relationship. We also chat with Tom Hunter from iHope Network, with Jennifer Amos from Encounter Telehealth, and with Mike Suters, an investor from Sandbox Industries, none of whom are affiliated with Health Further. In previous episodes, we've closely followed the patient story of 24-year-old Lucero Cifuentes, examining her personal experiences with depression in the context of the structures and systems that surround them. You won't hear from Cifuentes in this episode, mostly because her treatment and therapy has followed a pretty traditional path to this point. She hasn't used or maybe had the chance to use some of the new options coming online. BreatheAware, Encounter, and iHope Network are building the next thing largely through telehealth. They're here to tell you that there's more to telehealth than you might expect or realize. Today is a glimpse into where treatment for Cifuentes and others dealing with depression is going, and encouraging to us where it's already starting to be. For more examples of companies that are pushing forward innovative approaches in health, check out our original podcast series, The Future of Health. Finally, we're at chapter 15 of Contributing Factors, Holistic Health.
I'm Peter Herman. I'm the CEO of BreatheAware. I'm one of the two co-founders. And what we do at BreatheAware is provide next generation health training and education programs for both physical and mental health. And we do that all via a mobile media-enabled software as a service platform. And the platform allows us to really create personalized and branded engagement and patient data generation opportunities for healthcare providers.
Okay, so what exactly does that mean for someone using this product?
If you're a customer, you'll get to our product via your physician or therapist or PT provider, and you can also access it online. You'll access the product and you'll have the ability to take different programs. So we have a stress program and a pain program. We have a number of other free programs and lifestyle programs, one related to workplace health, another for people who travel a lot and how to manage their health in that context as commuters or road warriors. As a user, you log into the system and open up the app, and you have access to hundreds of different lessons that take you through structured programs that include breathing exercises and mindfulness exercises. There are videos that teach you how to use movement throughout the day, whether it's for a specific purpose like alleviating pain or just to be healthy. And then we work a lot on body alignment and becoming aware of how your body's positioned and used and what you're doing to it throughout the day that can keep it healthier and stronger and more flexible.
And how does the company interact with users of the platform?
We track all this and provide you feedback on how you're doing and help you set goals. And hopefully, you know, we're trying to make it a pretty engaging and enjoyable experience. And you know, that's something we're working on all the time, improving. But that's basically what it's like as a user. You get reminders also via your device or via email or text if you'd like it. And hopefully that'll keep you on track. And we tend to find that users of our products train using our tools about 3 to 4 times a week. We also keep our lessons really short. So the average lesson is about 2 minutes in length. So it's really easy to fit in.
And what's special about this?
So what's, I guess, unique about our programs is how they bring together a broad range of different techniques and concepts into single integrated programs. For example, our pain management product uses deep breathing and mindfulness and cognitive training, which are, of course, very much related to mental health. But we also combine physical movement and body alignment and other body work, along with concepts that are borrowed from athletic performance, such as imagery and training periodization, to create targeted clinical outcomes for the users of our programs or for their prescribing physicians. So we believe ultimately, as it relates to mental health, but also medicine in general, that integrating non-pharmaceutical and multimodal treatments into treatment models is the key to really transformative healthcare. And our goal is to enable that with content and technology.
This kind of mobile-based holistic health tool seems ideal for someone like Lucero Cifuentes, the individual patient we featured in previous episodes. Cifuentes has depression and lives in Madrid, thousands of miles from the family and friends she grew up with. Getting health and wellness lessons through her phone sounds like something that could benefit someone like her. In fact, telehealth is a quickly growing avenue for delivery of care, including for mental health. The New York-based startup health insurance company Oscar Health reported that its members' telehealth use increased by a third in the last year. This may have implications for the gaps in access we've discussed throughout the series. But does a program like BreatheWear really make a difference?
As far as specific outcomes, we look at it in two different ways. One is that the medical literature around mind-body work in general and how it relates to both physical and mental health is pretty overwhelmingly clear. The benefits are diverse, and it's really difficult to separate physical health and mental health. And one of the best ways to work on that connection and improve it in the patient or in a preventative way in a consumer is to engage in mind-body practices. The science is really clear about that. It's amazingly beneficial for reducing depression and anxiety, reducing suicidal ideation. Our products are going through a number of clinical studies at this time. So that's the second way we look at it. We want to show not just the efficacy of the techniques that we employ, we also want to show the efficacy of how those are delivered to patients and how they're delivered practically via a digital platform. And ultimately, we believe the key thing to all of this is for healthcare is integrating these types of treatments, which maybe are thought of as non-traditional treatments by some, into the actual healthcare treatment model so that it's not a question of seeking an alternative treatment, but actually you should be pursuing a combination of mind and body self-care approaches at the same time.
This echoes what we heard from nurse practitioner Mary Carter and clinical social worker Rachel Massell in episode 2, that it's not just about medication when it comes to treatment, but mind, body, multimodal, non-traditional, what does all this really mean?
Holistic is also a little bit of a loaded term. Wellness is where mind-body practices are often put in, but I think that does a disservice to it as well. And we actually find physicians, for the most part, are not only extremely aware of the science around these practices, but extremely supportive of trying to integrate it into their care models.
Of course, there's more to it than just getting the terminology figured out and then getting clinicians on board. It takes work on the part of the patient, too.
The impediments are that you know, we don't really know how yet. And ultimately, the difference between taking a pill or having a surgical procedure and approaching treatment from a mind-body perspective is about the patient actually doing things to improve their health. And that requires time and discipline and consistency. And it's not the type of thing you can do once. And although it might make you feel better in the moment, it's not going to have lasting effects. But if you do these things repeatedly over time, and in particular, again, if they're integrated into the care model of the physician or the healthcare provider, we find that people do this stuff and they get better and it helps them. And it doesn't mean that they aren't going to also get other treatments, but that, you know, a multimodal approach to health is not only mind, body work and exercise and diet. It is also, of course, you know, what we think of as traditional healthcare. It can be pharmaceuticals and it can be surgeries and it can be other interventions or treatments.
This is one of the trickiest but most important and necessary viewpoints to build on in healthcare. Our healthcare system has become so highly specialized, pushing each doctor to focus solely on her own specialty, that hardly anyone has the opportunity to work with the patient as a whole person with a particular lifestyle caused by the intersection of myriad external factors. But each of us is more than a system of organs. We're each a story. Our modern healthcare system doesn't make time for those unique stories. Instead, it's based on the assumption of standard medical treatments to address standard human biology, which is necessary for efficiency to some extent, but also prevents efficiency in other aspects. So what's the solution to this? Maybe it's the tools and programs outside the health system, like mobile apps, like BreatheAware. Maybe it's a new approach in medical school, training for doctors to understand the humanity behind human biology. Herman says that when he considers how to build the future he wants, he focuses on developing relevant content and on streamlining the process for sharing that content.
It's amazing what is being built and the innovation that's happening, whether it's in terms of data and analysis and predictive analysis and understanding really the life cycle of a patient, often before the patient understands where they're going, the data can predict it. There's so much going on in terms of biofeedback and I mean, nanotechnology and all of the different things that are out there. In terms of what we focus on, looking at how we can provide technology that is easy for physicians and hospital systems to use, how we can make it valuable to them in terms of tracking and managing their patients, how can we extend in some ways the amount of time that a physician or provider practice can spend with a patient by offering branded video opportunities to communicate with them via our platform.
As always, we want to know, why does this matter? How does it make health more affordable, sustainable, and accessible?
The big thing that we also see happening, that software in particular seems to be enabling, relates to access. And we're working with a number of rural hospital systems and providers who have patients with very limited access to healthcare. Their ability to get to specialists is very limited, and they often forgo healthcare simply for lack of access, and obviously cost figures into that as well. And clinicians are not blind to the business opportunities, of course, in that area too. And most of them are jumping in wholeheartedly and experimenting and trying new models and working on new things.
Herman says it's an exciting time to be working with technology in the healthcare industry. But at the same time, we at Health Further know it's tough to innovate in such a highly regulated industry, one with a lot of rules about things like payment structures. We asked Herman how reimbursement works for a platform like BreatheAware.
In general, the insurance market, Medicare and Medicaid have been very slow to reimburse non-pharmaceutical alternatives, but the tide does seem to be turning. The FDA is more rapidly approving digital health therapies. And amazingly, the techniques used in, for example, our pain management program are, according to the medical literature and research that's been done, more effective than treatments that are reimbursed today and that cause a host of all other issues.
Herman notes that one of those other treatments is opioids, which are useful in the short term after a surgery or injury, but can lose their effectiveness over time. And of course, there's the huge risk of addiction. Mind-body practices, on the other hand, when adhered to, can, in many cases, be effective over the long term for managing pain.
And the reality is that reimbursement is going to eventually be available to programs and to products that employ these techniques in a way that's structured and measurable and that clinicians can track and see the results of because they are effective.
Herman is optimistic about the growth he expects in the next year or so. After all, providers don't want costs to stand in the way of the patient's recovery. But there are plenty of reasons to be cautious when launching and managing a product like BreatheAware. We asked Herman what regulatory challenges he faces most often.
For us, it is mostly about patient data protection and HIPAA and making sure that we are staying on top of security controls as our product changes and as our data set changes and as we work with different companies. It's, you know, a sizable chunk of the work we're doing to sort of just keep on top of that. We definitely are starting to look at how products like ours can offer channels to telemedicine platforms and be integrated into telemedicine platforms. Many hospitals we're working with either have a telemedicine platform in place or are building one.
Telemedicine is growing in popularity. That's not exactly the category that BreatheAware falls into, since BreatheAware tries to help people before they need to go to a physician or other healthcare provider. But the field's growth is a good sign for any kind of telehealth product. This wave of interest in remotely administered health services makes Herman optimistic about his funding opportunities.
We've been really lucky to be able to have bootstrapped our company initially and then to have private investors. We are definitely optimistic about the marketplace and the need for products and services such as ours. The challenge I would say that we face and that we're thinking about every day is that technology is so democratized in some ways, and many of these practices are very available to people. So it's relatively easy to come up with a mindfulness product and put it online today. We're focusing a lot on doing what we do really well, which, you know, we see as very different from what the mindfulness apps you see out there doing. And to us, we think that's the important thing, you know, being integrated into the healthcare system and the treatment model, providing higher value to hospital systems and providers through branding and patient engagement beyond just delivering mindfulness training lessons.
Herman says BreatheAware differentiates itself through that broad approach. At this time, it's really tough to predict what new health products will succeed and which ones will flop. However, in an interview published in 2017, Herman notes that our current healthcare systems are perhaps surprisingly open to innovation.
It also doesn't mean they move quickly. Things take a long time. So for other healthcare entrepreneurs out there, I think, you know, I would say one of the lessons we've learned is that working with healthcare systems takes a long time. And that's okay. The things that healthcare systems are doing are very serious and affect people's lives in very real, tangible ways. And so it makes sense that these things take a while, but that is a challenge as an entrepreneur. At the same time, we find these systems are all, or most of them, very open to innovation. A lot of it's about just staying the course and keeping keeping with it and evolving and adjusting. So from a platform or technology perspective, we've tried to build our stuff to be as adaptable and flexible as possible as we figure that out with the guidance of those around us.
Chapter 16, Video Chat Therapy. As you probably know, telehealth is a broad category that doesn't just cover consumer-oriented tools like BreatheAware's platform or the Mindset app from Datadog Health. It has become a prominent and growing method of delivering traditional care.
My name's Tom Hunter. I'm the CEO of iHope Network. We're a behavioral health practice that does all of our work with our patients on video. So we're doing talk therapy for anxiety, insomnia, depression, other disorders of that type. All of our clinicians currently are master's level licensed clinical social workers, some LMHCs, and they are meeting with their patients on video instead of in an office. to help them resolve their issues and get better and go on to have successful lives.
Quick pause to talk about terminology. Hunter describes his company as a, quote, behavioral health practice. So far in this series, we've generally used the term mental health. As a clarification, behavioral health is a broader term that includes substance abuse disorders, something that often overlaps with mental illnesses like depression or bipolar. There is some debate over which term is better in what circumstances, but for our purposes, it really only matters to know that many products designed for people with behavioral health issues could also be said to be designed for people with mental disorders. Okay, back to iHope Network. As a mobile model, iHope addresses similar accessibility barriers that BreatheWear does. Hunter says that there are data collection advantages that actually make this type of system more effective than the traditional in-person healthcare model.
So the biggest single thing is the smartphone, right? Even 5 or 6 years ago, I mean, some people were getting therapy on their smartphone, but it wasn't necessarily very well thought out. It wouldn't, you know, Skype, for example, is not HIPAA compliant, and it certainly wasn't 5 or 10 years ago. You could intercept it. So now the number one thing that iHope does is break down barriers to access. A lot of our patients are people who's either they have mobility issues, or in some cases they work in sales and they are too mobile to get to a therapist because they're never in the same town on the same day, or they have busy lives, that kind of thing. And so it makes it possible for them to get treatment that they need to be successful.
Access to episodic care is one thing, but iHope and similar services also use technology to track their patients' trajectories over time, giving the clinician better insight into that patient's situation.
The second thing is with our team, and this is something that I hope more teams like ours will be doing in the future too, is getting people to do their PHQ-9, which is a measure of how depressed somebody is, or a GAD-7 is a measure of anxiety. You can get your patients to do those once a week and now track them in a database. And it's very easy for the patient now because they can do it on their mobile device. They can do it on their laptop. It only takes a moment, but it allows you to get a much clearer picture of how they're doing. And for example, if you're a therapist, you're meeting your patient once a week. They may be having a good day the day you meet them. They may not have a really clear memory of having a bad day on Wednesday and why, right? If you've got the tracking, if they've done a report at that time, you can ask them, all right, what happened? What was the cause for this? And then help them build a strategy to address that issue. So it allows you to get a much better understanding of your patient.
Of course, there are lots of patient privacy concerns when it comes to collecting and transferring patient data. That's one of the many challenges to overcome in healthcare innovation. Some of the change will be the ongoing cultural shift where people, especially younger people, are more open to their personal health data and personal data in general being tracked and shared. But we as a society definitely need to come up with more secure and fair ways to manage patient data. Blockchain technology is one new exciting method, but that's a conversation for another day. iHope makes patient data more accessible to providers and makes therapy more accessible to patients, overcoming traditional geographic barriers for those things. iHope also breaks down temporal barriers. Scheduling an appointment is a lot easier when you don't have to leave your house for it.
And we're still a fairly new company. We're doing business. We have clinical teams in 3 states, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Tennessee, and we're entering North Carolina over the course of the next quarter. But we are in service. We are treating patients. And so the hypothetical use case is the person who's in a rural area or the person who's mobile, because it's obvious to everybody that a person who has mobility issues, it's going to be a huge help to them to be able to do something at home that they would normally have to travel for 45 minutes to do. But what we're finding is that there are a lot more use cases. We do see people who have mobility issues, but we see a lot of people who are working a full-time job and have kids at home, and they're able to take a lunch hour to talk to us.
This same convenience factor can be an advantage for providers too.
The other piece of this, and I think this is a really important thing when you're looking at healthcare, is how are we treating our staff? What are we doing for them? And because we both make a really conscious effort to limit the amount of paperwork our clinicians have to do, and we handle things like we automate the billing for them and things like that, they can focus on their patient. But the other thing is, because they don't have to go into an office, they're more willing to work in the evening. We don't actually ask them to work on the weekends because I think that's sort of unfair, but in fact, occasionally they choose to. And this opens up opportunities for the patient as well. Now, we have one brilliant therapist who works early in the morning because she has two small children. And her entire patient panel is high-achieving type A people who only have time to get their therapy before they go to work. And who would have thought that that niche even existed? And again, we've broken down a barrier to access for them because we're able to get them therapy at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Like BreatheWear, iHope faces a challenging regulatory environment. In particular, when it comes to telehealth, providing medical care across state lines requires the provider to keep track of all kinds of state-by-state variations in health law. Hang on to your seats because there's a lot here. But as our society becomes more mobile and technologically connected, these issues have to be dealt with to ensure appropriate access to quality care.
So that is an area of huge complexity for us because even though we're still fairly early stage in rolling out, we're already a multi-state practice. And many of our college student patients are actually in more than one state over the course of a year, right? Because they go to school in Massachusetts and then they may go home, to New Hampshire, or they may go home to Connecticut or Tennessee or wherever it happens to be, or they may go and they may study abroad. And all of our clinicians have to be licensed in the state where the patient is receiving treatment. So that matters a great deal. And one of the things that we do is keep track of which states have which laws, because there are some states that provide exceptions, like Florida provides an exception to allow for snowbirds, people who are going down there in the winter and then coming back in the north in the summer, which allows us to treat patients on a limited basis in Florida if they're kind of home for winter break, for example. The other thing is telehealth parity laws. 31 states have passed laws that say that insurance has to reimburse for telehealth, but that leaves us with, and that gives us access to about 225 million people in the United States, but that still leaves more than 100 million people who don't necessarily get reimbursed. So that's an issue for us dealing with the payers. Some of them are wonderful and very forward-thinking and have good rules and well-thought-out processes for registering our clinicians and getting our reimbursed for the work that they do, but that varies. Let me put it that way. So the legal and regulatory situation is complex. You do have some states that have joined a mental health compact so that it's easier for people to cross-license. And one of the things that we do to make sure that there's capacity is cross-license people. So it's relatively, there are provider shortages everywhere, but they are worse in some places than others. And we have licensed people into states so that we could get better coverage and make it easier for somebody to find a clinician.
iHope keeps a database of all the relevant rules and regulations for each state.
For example, when we moved into Tennessee, we were able to register with TennCare in a matter of days. In some of the other states that we're in, it's either like Massachusetts is not a telehealth parity state, so there's no reimbursement from the Medicare or Medicaid providers. And in other states, the provider's process for registering clinicians may be slow, or they may have difficulties executing, or they may feel that their network is full and they don't need additional people. Sometimes they're not even really fully in compliance with the state regulation and law. But that's kind of the way it is. We like to work with in states where the environment is positive and the state is supporting innovative approaches to healthcare.
Likewise, reimbursement policies and rules vary state by state.
So first of all, there are many plans in many non-telehealth parity states that do not reimburse for telehealth at all. And then beyond that, depending on what kind of plan, like in Massachusetts, Blue Cross does offer plans that reimburse, but it also offers plans that don't. And sometimes if you're out of state and you have a less expensive plan that provides less coverage, they won't cover you, but they would cover you when you were in state. We actually just ran into that. And then there are other, United Healthcare, for example, is very forward thinking on this. And we have a national contract with them. So anybody from any state who's got a United Healthcare plan is covered. Knock on wood, at least so far, everybody that we've treated is covered. And then it starts to vary by state and again by law and regulation.
Hunter says state laws are generally moving in a good direction for iHope, though insurance might be always hard to navigate.
Every time a state passes a telehealth parity law, that is favorable to us. The legal environment is getting more favorable. I think the insurance environment is likely to remain complex because people like having a variety of plans and cost options.
There are challenges, but he still has an optimistic take on the opportunities for funding and growth for platforms like iHope.
Our vision is to have a very large team. We want to be national at some point. We went at the start of 2017, for example, we had access to about 7 million lives in Massachusetts. And at the end, by adding states, we were up to 15 million. By the end of Q1, we ought to be up to 25 million. And to treat those people, we need a lot of clinicians. So we're a more headcount intensive business, and the funding that we've seen has tended to go to people with technological solutions or who have been around longer and are multi-specialty. So we're kind of in a different model. And frankly, we are looking for funding, and we're looking for funders who are interested in exploring the digital health model where you're being a provider and providing the platform. We find that that's very powerful, right? Because you have the access. You don't have to get people to give you access to the patient data because you're treating the patients, and also because you can iterate quickly and improve your product more quickly.
Hunter's vision of the future of technology and mental health services: smarter ways to collect and use patient and consumer data.
We have a depression protocol that's 8 sessions, and the evidence shows that if you do these 8 sessions with your therapist, you're going to have 49 fewer depressed days over the next 2 years. But the problem is that it's hard to propagate those, right? A clinician has to go and read them and implement them, and they have to implement them the right way and so on and so forth. So in many cases, they sit on the shelf or they get used with a relatively limited number of patients. And so iHope was developed to be a channel that would allow that evidence-based treatment protocol to get to large numbers of patients quickly. And one of the things that our platform does is provide those resources and guidance to our clinicians so that they can do consistent work that's high quality with an expected outcome.
Hunter is excited about other technologies as well, like the emotion recognition software Affectiva. That kind of program can read the emotions on faces in video therapy, which could help a therapist develop a deeper understanding of the patient over time and maybe get to that understanding more quickly. But the first step in being able to use technology like that is having access to patients.
Some of my background is in the game industry. And if you look at the analytics that Google uses on, say, Angry Birds to see when people purchase and when they quit, you could do the same thing in a therapy session, and that would allow you to either provide training to your therapist or modify your protocol to better engage with your patients and provide higher quality care. But until you have the patients, you can't do that. And that's really the reason why we're focused on getting the patients. And there are, you know, a lot of people who are focused on building the really cool technology. And I'm looking forward to working with more of those people as we grow and we're able to provide the patients and the access to the new options for care.
For this episode, we also chatted with Jen Amos, the president and CEO of a telehealth company called Encounter. She points to cloud technologies as a major improvement for the affordability and accessibility of healthcare.
When I took over Encounter in November of 2015, we were using a very expensive EMR.
That's electronic medical record where patient information is stored.
That required to be managed and installed on a server that we owned and operated. We used an incredibly expensive video platform. Same, it had to be managed and installed in-house on a server. Since that time, we have moved to cloud-based solutions that are about 25% of the cost of those original IT platforms. They're cloud-based. We don't need additional IT support in-house to manage them. They're much easier to use for our providers and for our facilities where our patients are. We work almost exclusively with skilled nursing facilities to provide care for their residents in need. So that has been a real game changer, and I see that only continuing.
Like Herman and Hunter, Amos highlights the role of telehealth in making quality healthcare more available to more people. One thing that sets Encounter apart is that its target audience is specifically underserved communities throughout the Midwest and mountain states.
Of course, just the simple fact of being able to deliver care over a video conferencing platform has changed the delivery of care. We are treating individuals who have never received specialized behavioral health care before in their lives. We are treating individuals who have dementia, and have only received care from the local GP, who God bless them, but they are overwhelmed with very large patient populations. And a lot of those individuals on dementia who have dementia have been prescribed controlled substances that are really intended to treat people with severe mental illness. They use those medications off-label really to just shut those individuals down. They remove, by prescribing those drugs, you're removing any kind of quality of life for those individuals. We're able to go in with psychiatric providers. They specialize in these complicated medications. And we've been able to reduce the use of those controlled substances for those individuals. We've actually seen patients go home from the nursing facility, which really is unheard of. It wouldn't be possible without the technology, because you simply are not going to get these individuals with masters and doctorates who have spent years and substantial amount of money to go to school, and they are expected to be compensated at a certain rate and live a certain lifestyle, and they just are not going to move back to those small communities. And so this is how we remove those geographical barriers to get that specialized care to those individuals in need.
Amos looks forward to a time when patients don't even need to go into a clinic to see their general practitioner for basic vitals.
They'll say, oh, how much do you weigh today and what's your height? That doesn't work for what we're doing, because it's a little more complicated than that. So when we get to the point where, you know, your Apple iWatch or your Fitbit can collect all of that information and can also confirm that it is on the person who is your patient, then we'll remove a lot of the need for the brick and mortar.
Surely there will always be people who want to see their doctor for in-person checkups, just like there will always be a few folks who like shopping at malls. But it's not hard to imagine a future where brick-and-mortar clinics are obsolete. To find out more about what's on the horizon of healthcare innovation, we asked a healthcare investor, a guy whose job it is to successfully predict what innovative healthcare business ideas will succeed. This brings us to Chapter 17, Investing in the Future of Health.
I'm Mike Suters. I'm an investor at Sandbox Industries. We're a venture firm that focuses on spurring collaboration between innovative startups and larger companies. And I specifically work on our healthcare fund, which we operate with Blue Cross Blue Shield. Generally, we're just trying to find companies that lower the cost of healthcare and improve the quality of healthcare, which thankfully there's a lot of room for improvement in healthcare, so there's a lot of great opportunities.
We asked Suters what has changed in the healthcare startup landscape in the last 10 years. What's worked, what hasn't, and why?
I think there's been a lot of exuberance in healthcare technology, and for good reason. There's so much opportunity. I think what's changed over the last 10 years is that a lot of models that attempted to engage consumers directly in their healthcare haven't panned out quite as well. I think it's because to some extent in the United States, folks expect their health insurance to cover the vast majority of the healthcare they consume. So they're not really excited when somebody asks them to pay out of pocket for something else. What we've seen is a lot more success recently with healthcare technology companies that work together with existing stakeholders in healthcare, so hospital systems and insurers, and kind of work in collaboration with these larger institutions to try to innovate and affect change.
The portfolio companies that Suters is most excited about right now, one called Able2, which delivers cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, by phone or video chat. Able2 is designed for people who recently went through a major medical event or are dealing with chronic illness, since those factors put you more at risk for behavioral health issues.
So what Able2 does is solve a problem for folks, help them get back on their feet after a major episode using CBT, but also in the process reduces oftentimes avoidable medical expense in the form of a follow-up admission to the hospital, for instance, if that person is non-compliant with their care plan after they're discharged from a hospital because of anxiety or depression or something else.
Another portfolio company Suitors is jazzed about is called Behave Care. This one actually targets patients on Medicaid who have severe mental illness or substance abuse disorders. Behave Care manages a regional team of nurses and social workers who lead and advise someone called the care specialist, a single individual who builds an in-person relationship with the patient. Behave Care brings care directly into the home when necessary, augmenting the regular patient-physician dynamic.
And they have a team of community health workers that has a package of telehealth technology that they carry with them that allows them to essentially beam in a behavioral health specialist, a psychiatrist, or somebody else that can help that person manage a major episode in their care. So a psychotic episode, for instance, or even if they're just, their medications aren't being properly managed, they get on-demand, essentially, instant access to that specialty care and better management of their medications.
The care specialist also helps connect the patient to community-based organizations to address social needs, recognizing that social determinants of health can have even more impact than clinical care. In addition to all the different forms telehealth can take, making care more accessible, Suitors also has his eye on new models for data collection and analysis. New technologies make it easier for mental health professionals to measure the outcomes of their care.
They're trying to treat, you know, tens of patients a day, and the last thing they can think about is how to document a bunch of stuff. But it's an important process nonetheless, and we're excited about companies that are helping solve that problem, because if you better document the types of treatment that folks are receiving and the outcomes of those treatment, then obviously there's hopefully an opportunity to better align those two and improve the way that we treat folks with behavioral health conditions.
More generally, Suitors says there are two key things Sandbox looks for when evaluating a potential investment in the healthcare space.
The science is the best way to get folks in the industry excited about new innovations. So if a certain treatment or a certain data analytics approach shows really good statistical validity, clinical validity, that gets hospitals and health insurers really excited about working with them. In addition, I think there needs to be a way for them to work together, and this is kind of obvious, but a way in which everybody can win from a partnership. And oftentimes the way that that works is that you're taking dollars that have historically been incurred in the hospital setting, for example, huge dollars, right? An inpatient admission can be $10,000 to $30,000. So if you're working with a payer, for instance, that is a pot of money that they don't want to pay and that the patient doesn't want to incur. Nobody wants to go to the hospital. And so if you can figure out ways to eliminate those giant medical events, it creates a lot of flexibility to reallocate a portion of those dollars into better preventative treatment.
Sure, there's money to be made in the healthcare space, but there's lots more money to be made elsewhere. People like Suitors go into this industry because they genuinely want to make a positive difference in other people's lives. Suitors told us he chooses to invest in behavioral health innovations because his grandmother had schizophrenia in a time when cultural attitudes were even less accepting than today and treatment much more limited. Suitors is motivated to help people like her.
We were absolutely investing in an outcome. What we're truly trying to find is the key to achieving that outcome is figuring out a way for somebody to change their behavior and get them engaged in their health. And it's a tough nut to crack. And we don't believe that it's a one-size-fits-all solution at all. There's probably many different ways that you'd have to approach this problem depending on different people's personality types and underlying conditions, et cetera. But that's definitely where we're focused.
Next week, we wrap up season one. I'll be joined by my colleague, David Schifrin. We'll be taking a look back at our first five episodes to discuss the key ideas that stood out to us. We'll also talk about some of the process we went through to produce the series, and we'll present and discuss listener feedback. Contributing Factors is written, hosted, and produced by me, Caroline Leland. David Schifrin is our executive producer. Our original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. The track can be heard on his new album, so be sure to check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor. Matt Faulkner leads marketing, and additional creative assistance is provided by Michaela Powell. Special thanks, as always, to Lucera Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story. Many thanks also to Pete Herman, Jen Amos, Tom Hunter, and Mike Suiters. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, including the full interviews with everyone you heard today, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. While you're there, you can learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on. You can also find us on Twitter at Health Further. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts and then share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed, so thank you for being here and for helping us spread the word. Join us next week as we look back and close out this inaugural season.